Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by journalist Joey Watson, who is the host of the new podcast, Lone Actor, available on the Listener Network. Joey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Cam and Andy. It's really, really cool to be here on the show. I'm a big fan.
Joey, you've been covering the far and extreme right for a while. Could you tell us a little bit about how you found yourself on this beat?
I think my drive to far-right extremism came, I mean, maybe on a deeper psychological level. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. It's meant that I am acutely aware of the threat of far-right extremism, the fact that the great tragedies of the last century could easily happen again. And I think I'm sensitive to this whole field of inquiry. But then also, as I was coming into journalism, so Christchurch happened in 2019, now 6 years ago, I was 22 at the time, there was very much the feeling that this whole world was spilling across borders. It was becoming more interconnected. It was becoming more organized. It was becoming more prominent than it had been in a very long time. And I had the impression, even in the years leading up to Christchurch, that this was going to be one of the most important stories of our time. And when Christchurch happened, it very much brought that whole thing home in the most awful, shocking, tragic way.
Joey, as far as I can tell, the Christchurch massacre seems to have, in a sense, largely disappeared from public memory in Australia. Why do you think that is, and why do you think it's a good time to, I guess, revisit what occurred?
I feel very much like Christchurch, when it happened, it's brought this threat home in a really big, awful and spectacular way, where for a few days there, it was very, very difficult to ignore. But the terrorist had created this narrative around himself, to his manifesto, to his justification of his own radicalization, that he was this lone actor. And that was picked up in Australia as a convenient narrative, that we just came to see this guy as a fringe racist who'd been radicalized in strange places on the internet that never had, that most people had never heard of. We had a prototype for what a white mass shooter was from the Port Arthur massacre. But you know, as I started to look closer, I saw that this narrative didn't fit. There was a lot to uncover about who the terrorist was in the years leading up to the attack and who he was connected with. And I think because of that collective amnesia, a lot of that stuff had never been properly dealt with in Australia.
And one of the things you examine is, as you said, some rather obscure parts of the internet. Can you, I guess, begin to talk about how you began to explore that world and what you found there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like obscure is an interesting word, because I suppose it's obscure to people that aren't in them. It was an interesting period in the lead up to Christchurch where radicalization was happening in big organized ways, but in spaces that were invisible to most people. So the primary spaces that we associate with the Christchurch terrorist, right, is, of course, 4chan and 8chan, the universe of the chans. These are image board websites where irony rules. They are blanketed in this thick coat of ironic humor known as shitposting, where people put out highly offensive content and sometimes blur the lines between what is actually offensive and what's not, right? And they'd existed since as early as 2004 in the English-speaking parts of the world. And we know that the Christchurch terrorist had a long history there. And what we saw on 4chan in the years leading up to Christchurch is a collective radicalization. And there's a lot of different theories. There's been a lot of different theories as to why 4chan had gone Nazi in that period, for want of a better term. You know, some people explain it like it was just inevitable that a space which was focused on anonymity and uninhibited expression of sometimes very offensive ideas that would naturally go towards that. But what I saw when you look at the spaces like that were around 4chan, particularly when I focus on the window of radicalization of the Christchurch terrorists that I'd established, which was between 2014 and 2015, is actually there were parallel websites, you know, places like Iron March, where I know that you've spoken a lot about on the program, you know, which had a much more sincere tactical fascism that were hoovering users up from places like 4chan and 8chan and radicalizing them, and in turn making those spaces more radical. So you had this collective desensitization. And when you look at the nature of the propaganda that was putting out in those spaces, what happened in Christchurch, it's not, I mean, some people use the word inevitable, maybe not inevitable, but certainly become particularly explainable.
Joey, speaking of obscure parts of the internet, the Australian government recently prescribed Telegram, which is a collective of Telegram chats and channels that promote terrorism, white terrorism. Part of the justification was there was a link between Telegram and a foiled attack in New South Wales last year. That attacker was allegedly inspired by Christchurch. In some of the reporting about Telegram and its prescription, it was noted that after that attack was foiled, people overseas were discussing how they might replicate attacks like that in the future. Seems like there's a lot of foreigners involved. Is the Australian government doing enough to stop foreigners from radicalizing Australians?
Yeah, well, of course, the nature of the far right is in today's day and age is that it is interconnected, and often it's very difficult to trace where the ideology begins, where the violence is going to happen. I think, like, I see the growth of, well, okay, so firstly, I think it's important to say, like, Telegram in its history was hugely as a product of Christchurch, right? So after Christchurch happened, there was an awareness on places like 8chan, where the terrorist had, of course, posted his manifesto, asked for people to share his propaganda, gain support, that they were no longer going to be tenable. I mean, they were right to predict, and there are lots of posts that have been archived from this period of 8chan users that were right to predict that platform was no longer going to exist in its form for very much longer. And that did actually happen after two copycat shooters in the US by August that year. Cloudflare, the company that provided the web infrastructure for 8chan, stopped providing its protection, and it was at least temporarily removed. And so they were like looking for solutions to that problem, right? And that's where this big far-right move to Telegram happened. I mean, they'd already had, of course, been fascist organizing on Telegram before that period. Adam Waffen, for example, the Adam Waffen Division, which were an accelerationist skull mask terror group in the US, had already been looking towards Telegram and had started to organize there. But you had this really big uptake in the aftermath of migration, in the aftermath of Christchurch. And then in the other sense, then Christchurch also became central to Telegram's propaganda, right? There was this propaganda movie called White Terror that was made, I think, a year or so after Christchurch, that put Tarrant as being the original saint, and this whole idea of the beatification of white mass shooter saints in a pantheon of saints that therefore, you know, was carried out what Tarrant wanted to have carried out, which is people to do more terrorism in the image of the attack that he had carried out, right? So the other element of Telegram, which is like looking at from an intelligence or a surveillance point of view, is that it's almost like it almost speaks to this whole thing about like lone actor terrorism and where lone actors begin and the group ends, right? But historically, we have a pretty clear conception of what a terrorist organization might look like. This might be something like the order that there's, I mean, there's been a new movie just made about the order, like the Bob Matthews white supremacist group from the Pacific Northwest of America that, you know, was did a spate of killings and bank robberies in the 80s, where you have a structure, you have a vague membership, instructions are put down into the group and decisions are made collectively. Similar thing, you know, with the ideas of terrorism we might have with Al-Qaeda, right? But in the lead up to Christchurch, we had this model from groups like Adam Waffen, you know, which was a central node in a Skullmask network that was founded on the Iron March Forum that sprawled all across the world, where the model would be centralized and also decentralized, where, okay, you would have groups, you would organize, there would be things like hate camps where they would come together and they would have identifiable leaders, but also broadly it was just about getting as many people into the fold as possible. And, you know, as one former member says in the final episode of the podcast, you know, if you could get someone to just go out guns a-blazing, then that was considered a success. Telegram is like is even more decentralized. I mean, really what we're talking about is like a terrorist organization with no assets, no membership lists, no clear leaders. It makes me think that with the terror designation and the facing membership of Telegram, you know, would face up to 25 years in prison if you were found to be a member now that it has the designation. I mean, how that would be proven in a court of law, I'm not sure. And it almost, to me, it's like, if you'd imagine this in a pre-internet day, that this is what a terrorist organization would look like, it's like science fiction almost, right? It's like you never know how the terrorism's going to happen. You never know what, you know, you don't even know what a member looks like. But there is a sense of inevitability that it will happen because the instructions are happening and people are organizing for that to happen, right? And I think that speaks to one of the central tensions in the podcast of like, okay, well, when this is what a terror organization looks like, what does a member of a terror organization look like? And therefore, what does it mean to be a lone actor versus part of a group?
I think you would have to be a very silly Billy indeed to be convicted of being a member of Telegram.
But you seriously would, yeah, right?
There are some silly Billies out there, to say the least. You mentioned the tech response to the massacre. You know, Facebook was dealing with thousands upon thousands of versions of the video being uploaded. I recall that at one point YouTube just turned their search function off entirely for the entire website to stop people from being able to search the video. I can't help but feel, though, that if something similar were to happen in 2025, they might just let it ride. What do you think about how the tech sphere has changed since 2019?
Well, I think, you know, this weighs into that very complicated questions of the responsibilities of platforms, right? I think, you know, Facebook in particular plays a big role in this story. And that's not just on the day of the attack, because of course that's where the live stream was actually shared, but also because that's of course where particularly the Australian fascist groups were organizing, right? Like in the years leading up to Christchurch, we had the coincidence of these two hugely galvanizing political issues. That was the so-called migrant crisis in Europe and the rise of Islamic terrorism that was being hoovered up by this critical mass of people that had now emerged on Facebook because Facebook had grown in that time. And it was before its sheen had worn off. Like, you know, if you think about 2016, 2017, when you have organizations like the UPF and then the Lad Society radicalizing and recruiting members, you know, primarily using Facebook, that's before things like the Cambridge Analytica scandal had made us a little bit irksome of the organization and its general corporate responsibility and its relationship to democracy. You know, Facebook claimed that Christchurch was a wake-up call. I don't know how true that is. I feel like if you want to find extremist content on Facebook, you probably could now. I mean, you probably wouldn't have to click too many buttons, unfortunately. But I think also, like, on the day of the attack, like, the fact that the live stream was downloaded and re-uploaded so many times is also proof that, and I hate to be on the side of big tech here, but like Facebook was also a victim of a far more organized conspiracy than we really knew. Yes, Facebook obviously could have done more and should have done more in the lead up to the attack to clamp down on these groups. But yeah, I think this is the thing. Like the Tarrant had asked for groups to help share his propaganda, and they'd done things like hatching, you know, like subtly changing images or pixels in the live stream to get it into more places quicker. And yeah, so I think there's probably two ways of looking at it.
Joey, in addition to examining the dispersed nature of these terror networks or incipient terror networks. It seems like one of the other tensions you examine in the podcast is to do with, I suppose, on the one hand, there's this, the murderer's paranoia about the Great Replacement, his manifesto, his political vision. But it seems, if anything, that this has become, if it wasn't already, a more central concern for many in the political mainstream. How does that thing complicate this picture of him as a lone actor?
Yeah, well, the Great Replacement is a great example of the things that were happening directly in the years before Christchurch, right? That were changing the way the far right thought about and understood the threat of things like immigration and you know, Islam. The Great Replacement, of course, was a conspiracy theory that had been come out of French identitarian circles in 2011. But really, all it is a branding exercise, right? We're talking about the same things that the far right had been talking about for a really long time, you know, the so-called threat of immigrations. But instead of, you know, using terms like the failure to assimilate or you know, worrying about the threat of the of you know the, of refugees or whatever, it created this idea that actually immigration, we could package it into something that sounded like statistical and scientific and grand, and also gave it a sense of urgency. It's not just that, oh, there's going to be more migrants in the country and it might be bad for whatever experience of race that whatever extremists might have. It's actually, no, you like are tactically being replaced, it's being coordinated, it's being controlled, and it creates a sense of urgency around it. Tarrant had already been radicalized towards violence, we know from now his posts, before the Great Replacement had become prominent in English-speaking circles. But it provided a perfect platform for him to, a perfect platform and a perfect framing for him to justify the violence that he committed on this scale. And then, of course, Tarrant's attack was both the product of propaganda, but it was also propaganda in itself. So afterwards, the fact that he'd given his manifesto the name The Great Replacement meant that the concept gained a whole new audience within extremist circles. And then from extremist circles, it filters more and more into the mainstream. And now we're hearing it more and more. Of course, like, you know, the justification of saying, oh, yeah, it's just like, it's just true. It's completely meaningless, right? It doesn't, no one has any central idea of race. No one even has any central definition of what a migrant is, right? So it's like, you can just say it, you can sound statistical, you can sound like this threat is greater than it is, but it doesn't actually mean anything. And I think that's tragic and dangerous and scary.
In addition to following the traces that the killer left online, your journey also takes you to places like Austria and Bulgaria and Serbia. Why did you visit those places and what did you discover about his formation as a result of that?
Yeah, so in the years leading up to the attack, Tarrant had traveled extensively. He'd done three massive trips. He'd gone to Africa, the Middle East. He'd done one of those North Korea tours. But particularly important were these two trips that he'd taken to the Balkans, to Central and Eastern Europe, really. In the Balkans are interesting for two reasons. In the first trip, he had gone through Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia. These are, of course, the setting of, you know, the war of the 90s, the victims of which were predominantly Bosniak Muslims, where people had, you know, actively killed on the grounds of race and religion. And it became a great source of propaganda, inspiration for the propaganda that he created. He'd painted on his guns the names of, you know, Serbian warlords from the Middle Ages and stuff like that. But it was also there that he'd taken his first mobilization to violence. Well, that's how the Royal Commission, New Zealand's Royal Commission, described it. He'd sent an email to the Bruce Rifle Club in January of 2017 from Croatia, you know, before he'd even moved there, before it was established that he'd had any link to New Zealand whatsoever. And so this became a particular focus, especially because then just months before the attack, he returned to the Balkans, this time to Bulgaria, where he left behind a trove of Facebook photos showing his visits to ultra-nationalist sites of Bulgarian resistance against the Muslim Ottoman Empire. And I really wondered, like, like why? Like, historically, the far right have been interested in the protection of Europe, of course, but more important was arguably the Reconquista and the Muslim control of Spain, for example. But what, you know, where this Balkan control? And that's why, when speaking to people in Bulgaria, researchers in Bulgaria, people involved in intelligence in Bulgaria, I found out about these migrant hunter groups that were operating on the Turkish-Bulgarian border, who had become prolific in the years leading up to the attack, promoting Balkan history or Balkan history and using Balkan history as a justification for their violence, particularly that history of their resistance against the Ottomans. And by violence, I mean carrying out expeditions against migrants that were trying to cross the Turkish-Bulgarian border to make their way into Europe, you know, rounding them up, doing vigilante activities. And there's certainly a theory within Bulgarian intelligence that Tarrant had actually had contact with this group, so at the very least had received some of their propaganda, and it really helps to explain the exactness of all of these places that he'd gone to. There's all of these places, these historical places he'd gone to, that had, you know, then ended up in the propaganda of his attack. I mean, it was bizarre being there. I mean, traveling through rural Bulgaria, it's certainly a place that's become a magnet for far-right activity in Europe. There's a feeling that because of the looseness of the institutions and the far right has a very decent proportion of influence over Bulgarian parliament, that the far right can get away with more there. And I've never seen so many swastikas in my life. I feel like anti-fascists in Bulgaria, the anti-fascists that I met, really have their work cut out for them, in that they live with a very real threat of political violence. And yeah, I mean, it couldn't have not have felt more obscure to Australia. And so that was a very interesting explanation to come to for why Tarrant might have been there. The only connection I could think of otherwise that I noticed is that, you know, Serbia and Australia are the only two countries that have a loss to the Ottoman Empire at the core of their national mythology. But, I mean, the fact of the Ottomans being Muslim is not really built into the Gallipoli myth. So it was very strange, and I needed to find out more about, you know, why he was there. And that was the dominant explanation that I came to, at least from within Bulgarian circles. The other trip you mentioned was to Austria, which was just after Bulgaria. So we're really talking very, very late into 2018, really months before his attack. He's pretty much, we know from planning documents, was completely ready to go by this stage. And so the trips in themselves become very suspicious. But what the reason Austria was also suspicious is because Tarrant had donated quite a considerable amount to the Austrian identitarian extremist Martin Zellner. And for that reason, yeah, he donated, and that then became a focus for New Zealand investigators, right? It turns out that they'd exchanged a whole bunch of emails. They'd arranged to meet immediately after the last email from Zellner. Tarrant had booked a hire car for his week in Vienna. New Zealand investigators had concluded that he wouldn't have met with Zellner because he wouldn't have wanted to attract a security attention to himself so close to the attack, which when I got to Austria, I started to realize was inconclusive, because at the time, I'm not sure if you remember, but the Freedom Party, the far right Austrian party, had come to power in 2018, and they'd taken control in their minorities through their minority government. They were a minor party in a coalition with the Conservative Party, had taken control of the Ministry of Interior, and were actively undermining the intelligence agency. And I spoke to people within the intelligence agency that were tasked with monitoring the far right in this period, and their work was actually like being actively sabotaged. And that directly coincided with, well, the period of Tarrant's donations to Zellner, his trip to Austria, and then the attack itself and the investigation that happened afterwards into what had happened. So it felt deeply unresolved.
It reminded me, or was reminiscent of, the failures, let's call them, of German intelligence in relation to the NSU. And investigative journalists have since uncovered a number of worrying facts about the extent to which the German intelligence services had actually penetrated the extreme right within Germany and had their own reasons to suppress information about the NSU's activities. So it's quite worrying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's deeply worrying, right? Because, and in terms of the lone actor narrative around Christchurch, around Tarrant, I mean, I don't want to sensationalize it in any way or be a conspiracy theorist, but here you have clear links between Tarrant ideologically and then through an email exchange, at the very least, with Martin Zellner, who is then clearly linked to a far-right political party that has real power in Austria and has now just been re-elected again. You know, as one former politician who had a national security portfolio told me in Austria, it's like, you know, you've got to understand here that the Nazis aren't on the fringe. They're in the building and they're running the race. And, you know, while I was, you know, in Austria, I met sources at like at Café Spöll, you know, one of the famous Austrian cafes where Hitler supposedly frequented. You know, it was just around the corner from the art school that he'd been rejected from. I feel like there's very real reason to be anxious, and it spells out in loose terms, how big and interconnected this threat actually is.
Joey, I think that this podcast is a very good example of how you should report on the far right. Some of the reporting in Australia and elsewhere on the far right is a little bit lacking. What were some of the things that you took into account when you decided to approach this story, and how did you approach it responsibly?
Well, Cam, I think like at the heart of this investigation, and I say this completely authentically, was the questions of the victim community, right? I had come up with the concept of doing this story very much because I felt like Australia hadn't dealt with this properly and that there hadn't been a meticulous engagement yet, despite the extreme significance of this event. But I wouldn't have done it unless I had the blessing of and the desire of at least some members of the victim community. Of course, I can't speak to the whole victim community. There would be a lot of division. But I found that as soon as I started to make contact with people, I found that there were real questions around exactly the line of inquiry that I wanted to take. You know, there was a feeling that there were things missing. Like, for example, the hard drive of the terrorist had never been found, which is a big barrier, both for New Zealand investigations and for me in the podcast. You know, the feeling like there were things that were missing, parts of his trajectory in the years immediately before the attack that were not accounted for. The period of his radicalization had never been clearly established. So doing like authentic victim-led reporting was really like a place to start from. The second thing that I tried to do was, well, I think I did successfully, was like not to talk to Nazis unless it would absolutely be essential or help the investigation to move forward, and then only to talk to them about the things that I wanted answers on and that I could assess the accuracy of based on what they told me, right? The thing with far-right extremism, you know, and this is the whole idea of optics that became very popular with the far-right, is that unlike any other group, more so, I'd say, than any other extremist group, they're extremely good at deceit. They actively talk about optics, about putting out an image that is different from what they actually want to achieve. And that's why they're so vulnerable. Well, it's one of the reasons that they're so vulnerable to infiltration, because, you know, that they say, for example, the leaders leading up to Christchurch, they frame themselves as an anti-Islam group. You know, they show up at Bendigo and claim to be just, you know, one of the people, but actually, you know, behind closed doors, they're talking about race wars and worshipping Hitler and all this stuff. So you're never going to be able to gauge what's propaganda and what's not if you just talk to Nazis on their terms. And so for that reason, even though it's a podcast about far-right extremism, you won't really hear many far-right extremists, if any at all, in the podcast, because, you know, it's about trying to reconstruct Tarrant's trajectory, and anything that didn't serve that purpose, that very clear purpose, which I discussed with the victim community and I'd established within myself was a good and worthy thing for journalistic inquiry, that was out, right? So yeah, I mean, those are a couple of things. It's always like extremely difficult to navigate, and, you know, still now I'm anxious with the product and I think about whether there were things I could have done differently. I might also say, like, just, you know, in broad terms about what the Australian media got wrong at the time, which I think to the lone actor narrative that surrounded Tarrant afterwards, was this descent onto Grafton, right? I mean, it was like, so many of these spaces, 8chan, certainly Iron March, the Daily Stormer, which I haven't necessarily spoken about, but the Daily Stormer, like, you know, all of these spaces where this radicalization was tactically taking place, that were actively trying to create Tarrants, were completely invisible to most people, and including journalists. And so Grafton became swarmed with people afterwards, and that led to international journalists afterwards, and that led to a lot of resentment from the community, because, look, of course, radicalization is a complicated is always a complicated story. And while there probably are things, explanatory things to find in Grafton, it really wasn't the main event here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bold assertion, but there probably is a little bit of racism in many country towns in Australia. It might not be the key thing. I think we'd be seeing a lot more terrorism if it was just about country town racism.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, racism is a problem that I think you can find in all facets of Australian society. But I'm not going to say like there aren't things in Grafton that can't explain, that can't have some explanatory value to the attack, right? So all of those traditional things, if you want to talk about radicalization, that are reflected in the literature going right back to Hannah Arendt and probably before, you know, they are present there and they can be applied to Tarrant's life there. You know, for example, the breakdown in social bonds. A lot of people I spoke to in Grafton, you know, told me that there'd been a big transition over the last 20 years from the town being, you know, historically industrial, particularly in the dairy industry, towards it being more and more focused on the economy that revolved around a Supermax prison that had opened just outside of Grafton, you know, a few years ago. An update from the historical Grafton prison, which is now closed down. And that had changed the constitution of the town, and the way people related to each other had changed considerably, you know, in the years, especially that the Christchurch terrorists was growing up. There's also, you know, of course, something to be said about the impact of personal trauma. I mean, Tarrant really did have a difficult upbringing, and a lot of bad things happened. He lost his dad to cancer. There was some stories about an abusive relationship in his mom's second marriage. There was even a story that his dad had eventually committed suicide before the cancer could kill him, and that Tarrant had even had a hand in organizing to euthanize his father. So there definitely is like unquestionably tragedy there. But, you know, of course, that doesn't explain what happened in Christchurch. And then when you start looking at what happened after Grafton, which we didn't do super comprehensively, certainly immediately after the attack, you can see, oh, actually, no. What happened was organized and tactical and happened really in the 4 years before the attack and was a product of real things that were going on online and in the real world.
Joey, the killer had many fans on the far right, many of whom continue to organize and present in contemporary Australian political life. What do you make of the situation of those groups now in 2025?
I feel like this is not so different to what I was saying about Terragram, where we've had merging of ideas into its worst possible form, right? So in the years leading up to Christchurch, we firstly had the UPF, which was a street movement that was supposed to become a political party but failed to organize to be able to become one. They strategically then pivoted into the Lad Society, which was, you know, as its leader, Tom Sewell, said at the time, was, you know, trying to build a quote-unquote parallel whites-only society in Australia. But then at the same time, you had this parallel group, which was this skull mask neo-Nazi network forming on Iron March, the Iron March Forum, which, you know, at the time they looked like disparate groups. There was Adam Woffen in the US, Sonnenkrieg in the UK, but now we know from the Iron March leaks that they were actually all nodes on the same network. And in Australia, we had Antipodean Resistance, right? And so you have a terroristic element and this pseudo-political whites-only society-building element as the two core parts of the Australian far right that Tarrant had been connected with in the years up to Christchurch. What happened after then was the establishment of the NSN. You know, you've spoken about this a lot on the program, is a merging of the two and really taking on far more of the characteristics of Antipodean Resistance than they did of the Lad Society, right? So it's almost like a devolution towards the most extremist form of far-right ideology, and that the violence that was being masked by some of the more moderate groups, I mean, is certainly less masked now. But I'd be curious what you guys think of that. I mean, what do you reckon?
I guess I'd view these contemporary developments in terms of their recent historical context. I do think that those sentiments were present from the very beginning. How they expressed themselves was a matter of political calculation. So I think that the kinds of commitments, political commitments that you find in evidence in groups like the NSN were always present. I do think that perhaps for better or worse, those political commitments are more able to be expressed now because there's been years of building towards it. And in the same manner that Islamophobia and xenophobia are employed as tactical devices, they're employed in order to build a cadre, essentially. And I suppose it's a gamble, I think, to be so explicit. In other words, there's less time spent being apparently merely edgy online or, you know, engaging in those kinds of ironic but not really ironic forms of online commentary that pander to racist sentiment in a more palatable fashion. I think a lot of those sorts of tactics have been abandoned because they're no longer necessary. And yes, there is, I think, always that tactical question concerning the development of exclusivist communities that can form the basis for a social movement. And on the other, I guess what in a sense undermines those claims is the apocalyptic rhetoric that's engaged in, where, you know, they're trading on a sense that Australian society and Western civilization as a whole is in crisis. And so dramatic action is required. And what they have, I think, consciously tried to do in terms of at least some of their public propaganda is to assert that this is a preferable means of expressing that dissent than it is, you know, as it took form in Christchurch in 2019. So there's, I think, latent threat that's always present and I think forms part and parcel, especially of neo-Nazi ideology, that says, look, you can either let us do what we want to do, freedom of speech, yada, 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 or you'll force us underground. And if you force us underground, it's in those circumstances that these kinds of violent episodes take place. I'd suggest that either course produces great violence, so it's objectionable in any sense. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, based on my own investigations, those sentiments were always present. Whether or not they're expressed and how is very much a tactical decision. I think the other thing that I think is worth emphasising is, in these contexts, is however repugnant these ideologies may be, and I think they are, very often those involved are rational political actors. They think about what it is that they want to achieve and they set about trying to achieve it with whatever resources that they have available. And in that sense, I think they should be taken perhaps more seriously than they might otherwise be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that speaks to the heart of this investigation, right? It's like Christchurch was not an aberration. He was, you know, in his own way, dealing with a rational paradigm that said that this was the only logical thing for him to do. Like, he didn't have any known history of mental illness, for example. He had no criminal history. He had just been radicalized into a way of thought that he, at that point in time, saw as rational or his only option. And, you know, I would say in terms of that optics thing and what you were saying about how it feels like less and less, there are less and less tactical decisions made to cloak the truth of what this ideology says. It's very much like, you know, in the year before Christchurch in 2018, you know, Robert Bowers, who'd done the attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh, had written on his Gab, "Screw your optics." And it feels more and more like the optics are being screwed, that they're being done away with altogether, and we're getting this final form terroristic fascist element. But, you know, in many ways it's almost inevitable, right? That's the truth of the far right, is that all roads do lead there, right? There's no way, if the vision of your politics, and this is why I have, you know, such big problems with people like Martin Zellner and his supposed nonviolence, is that if the vision of your politics is to other or separate elements of your society, and that's at the heart of what you're trying to do, like, Christchurch is actually the only outcome. It's just a question of whether it happens within the context of a fascist state in which that violence becomes acceptable, or whether it becomes, you know, or whether it happens within the context of a liberal democracy and then looks like an aberration to most people. But yeah, it's scary times.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
I can see the thing is, like, if you take the subject seriously, read about the Nazis. It attracted all sorts of highly educated, cultured men and women who could not be relegated to, you know, a psychiatric institution. These were very mainstream, in a sense. And that's the danger, and that's the importance of trying to, I think, apply pressure to prevent those developments from taking place here and now. And I think also, perhaps on the flip side, I do think there's beginning to be an increasing sense that if you examine things that are happening, of course, in Austria and Germany and parts of Europe, but in North America and across the world, these sorts of forces, however repugnant they may seem to many, can and will attempt to assert themselves in ways that are highly destructive and really are deserving of critical scrutiny and staunch opposition.
Mm. It is actually crazy. And this is one thing, because I've spent so much time frying my brain on extremist content. It is crazy how it's almost like magical how mobilizing this made up concept of race can be. And you know, why I don't like to give compliments to extremists, they do have wild imaginations that they can take this concept with no scientific backing and create in whole ideologies and worldviews around it, no matter how destructive they might be. I mean, like, speaking of like Nazi high society, I've become really obsessed with the Annenerbe. I don't know if you've spoken about the Annenerbe before on the phone, but that was Heinrich Himmler's race think tank that he'd set up within the SS. And mm-hmm. they were just like doing the craziest stuff to make this made up idea of Aryanism sound respectable, you know, going to sending scientists to Tibet to measure skulls to look for lost civilizations, and, you know, encouraging Nazi Germany to exclude Iran, at least in the early years, from any Nazi racial policy in the course of world domination, because the Iranians were in some way related to the original Aryan race. Like, it's like totally like Fruit Loop stuff. But that's the thing. I mean, it's all Fruit Loop, right? Because it has no basis. But it is crazy and deeply worrying how, as you say, at all levels of society, how mobilizing it can, how unbelievably mobilizing it can be. And I think we're seeing that more and more, you know, whether it be through, in its most extreme form, through right-wing terrorism, through Christchurch and the people that have been influenced by Christchurch since, or whether we see it in, well, let's call it, for want of a better term, civil society.
Well, Joey, we'll have to leave it there. The podcast is called Lone Actor. It's part of the Secrets We Keep series on Listener. All of the episodes are available to listen to on Listener right now. I don't recommend listening to them all at once, but which is what I did, but you can. And if you think that you know everything about Brendan Tarrant, you definitely don't. So it is very well worth a listen. Joey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will have some people to thank for the Radiothon next week. We managed to raise a little bit over $4,000, I believe, which is what I explicitly asked people not to do. I didn't want to set expectations so high. So we did smash through our goal. Thanks a lot, guys. But I will thank you personally next week. See you then.
See ya.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are. At home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.